I'm Ethan McSweeney, the new artistic director of the American Shakespeare Center, Shakespeare's American home in Stanton, Virginia, and I'm talking with Rabbi Saul Solomon on Dave's Gone By on UNC Radio.
Oh, shalom, damn it! This is your old pal, Rabbi Saul Solomon, founder and spiritual leader of Temple Sons of Bitches in Great Neck, New York. And I am so delighted to get all Bardian and Shakespearean with you today, because as you know, I love the theater, and I love talking about even Shakespeare, which can be something of a slog, I have to admit, but not today, because we're going to be talking with someone who is taking over the American Shakespeare Center of Stanton, Virginia. His name is Ethan McSweeney. You know that name because he has directed on Broadway. He directed the 2000 revival of The Best Man with people like Spalding Gray and Chris Noth and Charles Durning. He also did that adaptation of the John Grisham book A Time to Kill with people like Patrick Page and friend of the neighborhood Tanya Pinkins and Tom Skerritt. And, oh my God, he's directed so many places. He's at the Dublin Gate Theater, the Guthrie in Minneapolis, the Old Globe in San Diego, the Stratford Festival. We are talking with Ethan McSweeney and are delighted that he's taking the time with us today. Shalom, Ethan!
Shalom, Rabbi.
How you doing? How's it going?
Very well, thanks.
Now, how long have you been in this new job as artistic director of the American Shakespeare Center?
6 whole days.
Oh, my God! Mit Mazel mit Glück. So are you settling in? Are you learning the phone system?
I'm learning the phone system. I've almost got my email account going. Yesterday, I printed my first document. So, it's a little bit like trying to jump on board a moving train right now, but it's a really exciting process.
Now, this train was run for the last 30 years by the same guy, the guy who basically founded or co-founded the place. So how did you find out about this job, this opening, and you know, what do you think that you bring to the table? So that's the reason they chose you.
So American Shakespeare Center started out as the Shenandoah Shakespeare Express, and it was the brainchild of a guy named Jim Warren and his English professor Ralph Cohen. And Jim was a student at James Madison University here in the Shenandoah Valley, and they had been going to see plays, Shakespeare plays, in England, and they thought that they could do a better job. Mostly they thought that the plays were being done with too much decoration and scenery and all sorts of things, and that the story and the authentic Shakespeare was getting lost. And so they set about to produce in what is kind of called original practices, which means we go back and we look at how we think it might have been done in the Elizabethan era. And they had a lot of success, and they toured. I toured Virginia, they toured Maryland, they toured all the way to Maine and all the way to Texas. They got to 3 other continents, and they were doing their thing. And then the citizens of Stanton, Virginia, decided that they wanted to build a theater to help revitalize their really beautiful downtown neighborhood, which is one of the top 15 small towns in America,
ooh,
according to, I think, Fodor's travel guides last week. So they built, and they approached Shenandoah Shakespeare Express, and they said, well, what do you want to build if you would build a theater? And Shenandoah Shakespeare Express said, well, we're not sure we want to build a theater because our whole methodology is built on the fact that we tour, and because we tour, we don't do scenery and we don't do lighting cues, and every sound cue and music cue we make ourselves. But if we were going to build a theater, we would like to build it just like Shakespeare's indoor theater at the Blackfriars, which was a recovered monastery space that some of Shakespeare and his colleagues got in the early 1700s in London. And wouldn't you know it, they raised the money and they built here a stunning, beautiful, all oak wood recreation of Shakespeare's indoor theater, the Blackfriars Playhouse. It's the only one in the world, and it is as authentic as we could make it in the 21st century. And we perform the plays here in repertory. We do plays of Shakespeare's. We do plays written by some of his contemporaries. We just started a new program called Shakespeare's New Contemporaries, in which we're commissioning new writers to write companion plays that would go with a Shakespeare play,
ooh,
and be performed under our signature performance conditions, which are leaving all the lights on and not doing anything that can't be made by hand. So it's a very handmade art form, authentic to Shakespeare. And I, listen, I'll tell you, Rabbi, I had been traveling all around the world directing Shakespeare, and every once in a while I'd hear about American Shakespeare Center, and I'd say, yeah, I got to get down there. Finally, last fall, I got a call from the search firm that was looking for the replacement for this original founder, Jim, and they said, do you have any suggestions of people? And I gave them some good names, people I thought would be really good at this job. And then I said, you know, but I've never been there. Would it be possible for me to just pay a visit over the holidays? And I might be in the area because I got some family down here. Could I just come? I'll just come in. I don't need to see a play. I just want to see the theater. And I came in, and I walked into the theater, and I was surrounded by this wood and this scale that is both intimate and epic. And, this, you know, theaters are really magic, sacred spaces, and they have in them a kind of smell sometimes of what has happened in them. And this theater, it had a real good smell. And I walked out of there. My wife was with me. We got in the car, and she said, don't you think you should apply for this job?
Well, how do you do? I mean, did you feel a little bit when they first called you, like, how come they're not even, they're asking me for recommendations? How come they didn't think of me just as the guy?
Well, you know, I think they thought, oh, well, he's more, you know, he's got this big freelance career. He's been on Broadway. He doesn't want to come to lovely Stanton, Virginia and run a theater. And little did they know that really one of my big ambitions was to come and run a classically oriented theater. And I wasn't offended. I thought, oh, they didn't think of me. And then I thought, I called the guy up and I said, you know, is it too late? I mean, I gave you all these good names. Maybe you've already found what you're looking for. And he said, no, it's not too late. And I put my name in, and then they put me through an incredibly rigorous search process. I mean, it's not like everyone said, oh, welcome Ethan McSweeney. I mean, I had to go through a series of interviews that if we would put our political candidates through this kind of interview, we'd have a whole different
give up. Well,
politics.
What did they, because you can stand on your resume, on your body of work, what did they expect you or to hear from you during the interview process?
They wanted to hear a little bit about what I thought of them, I think, and what I was going to do here and what kind of artistic director I was going to be. And being an artistic director is not the same thing as being a director. There's a lot of overlap, but there's, you know, one of them means thinking about an organization and one of them means thinking about the play that you're doing at that time. And I think when you think about an organization, it's got a lot more commitments. It's got commitments to more people, the staff that works here. It's also a civic act. It's got a commitment to this town. And, you know, I've been saying to people, if you want to be a destination theater, and that's what American Shakespeare Center is. It's a place where people, a lot of people want to come here, spend the weekend, see four or five plays, go have some fantastic meals, stay in beautiful boutique hotels, and just be in the Shenandoah Valley. But if you want to be that, you got to be a great town to visit too. And Stanton is a great town, and it's a growing town, and one it's got a real good feel to it right now. It's young, it's hip. There's a couple of universities nearby. It's a real great spot.
Now, for people who are thinking of visiting, first of all, if you're going to Google it, Stanton has a U in there somewhere. I don't know.
Yeah.
Why they don't call it Staunton? I do. Have you ever explored that? You're calling it Stanton. Everybody says Stanton, but it's spelled Staunton. What's wrong with people over there?
Staunton. Yeah, you hit the nail on the head there because we got a branding problem. But we're in Virginia, you see, and I'm from Washington, D.C., and I spent most of my life living in New York City, so this is my first time really living below the Mason-Dixon line.
Ooh.
But in Virginia, Staunton is pronounced Stan.
Huh. Well, I guess that's my fault.
Your fault.
Yeah, or Gevalt, I should say. No, I'm kidding. We're talking with Ethan McSweeney, the artistic director. Now, also for people, since we have a lot of people who listen in New Jersey and New York and especially Borough Park, I'm wondering, where are you in relation to Washington, D.C.? Where is Shenandoah Valley? What does it take for someone who's living in or near Manhattan or Long Island to get there?
Yeah, can I shout out to Borough Park? Because I live in Bay Ridge in my New York life. So.
You know my homies, or my shlomies, I should say, yes.
So the Stanton, Virginia is about 2 hours drive from Washington, D.C., right down into the heart of the Shenandoah Valley, which is some of the most beautiful valleys and oldest mountains in our country's history. I mean, this goes all the way back. There are buildings in this town, Rabbi, that go back to like 1703. Ooh. That's how old this area is. And you get here by car. You can fly into the Shenandoah Valley Airport. You can fly into Richmond or Charlottesville, both of which are nearby. And I haven't done it yet, but there's a train.
Oh, my God.
Train that goes from Union Station, Washington. It goes four times a week out and four times a week back. And it goes from D.C., I think, to St. Louis, and it stops in Stanton. So there's a lot of different ways to get here. Once you get here, you're going to want to come and stay for two or three days.
Yeah, it's not a day trip from New York, but it's a...
Yeah, no, you'd want to come and, you know, this place thinks of itself. People do this. You know, they go up to, you mentioned in my intro, Stratford, Ontario in Canada, where there's a famous Shakespeare festival that got its start exactly like this one did. The town elders said, we want to support an industry in our town that's renewable. We were an agricultural town and that's sort of dying out. So we're gonna start a theater. And 50 years ago, and now it's the biggest theater in North America. Same thing happened in Ashland, Oregon. You may have heard of the Oregon Shakespeare Festival. Super famous.
Yes.
Shakespeare Festival in this country. More popular in the West, probably, than the East. Although I remember as a kid, my parents, you know, I don't know, we were maybe going to California to see Yosemite, and so we made a trip to see Shakespeare in Ashland. You know?
Oh, now here it starts. So your parents obviously encouraged your love of the theater. Did they realize that you were going to be an artistic soul and not going to be a doctor or a lawyer kind of thing?
You know, I don't, you know, that's a good question. They took me to a lot of theater, and I don't know if they had an intention for me to go into it or not. I mean, I thought I wasn't going to be in theater. I was going to go to college and do something else. I thought I was going to be a journalist or a foreign service officer or something like that, and I just kept at it, and theater kept finding me. And I think when you are born with a creative soul, the art keeps finding you.
Well, here's the deal. By the time you got to college, you already knew. You were already pursuing this. And this surprises me. This sort of shocks me. You went, not that you went to, Columbia University?
Go Lions, yeah.
But, well, it's not that you went there, but that you got the first bachelor's degree in theater. How is that?
Yeah.
Didn't they have that for 100 years?
No, not Columbia. Columbia, Rabbi, was all about only the great books and serious learning, and they didn't have time for something as frivolous and as theater. The arts were not something that a serious Columbia student could study until I got there, and they were just starting to open up arts as major tracks, and I got on a committee to help them formulate the theater major, and then when I went to declare, they said, well, you would be the first one. Would you mind going to the bursar's office and finding out what the paperwork is?
Well, because I figure, you know, there wouldn't be a firm that'd be like 12 or 20 firsts, and you'd be letter M, so you might be the sixth. But no, it was just you.
It was just me. And, you know, we started a theater major there that I didn't know at the time, but I got involved in making it. But we said, let's make a theater major that's like, it fits into Columbia's values, so it will be heavy on literature and reading and cultural studies and art history and music history. And you know what I was creating was really a directing major, and I didn't know it at the time because I didn't know what a director was, and I didn't know I wanted to be a director. But what I made was something where I didn't have to take quite as many acting classes, the way a lot of theater departments are much heavier on performance, and this was heavier on academic and study.
Now, this reminds me, one of our guests over the years on Dave's Gone By is a professor, a Shakespearean scholar named James Shapiro. Did you have him?
Oh, my God, yes, yeah, I did. Taught a class with another legendary professor. Now Jim is a legendary professor in his own right, but at the time when I was there, he was like the young upstart, changing the world of Shakespeare scholarship, and he taught there was a year-long Shakespeare class, and you could take the first semester with this guy Ted Taylor and the second semester with Jim Shapiro. Brilliant teacher, and you know, his books on Shakespeare have been super inspirational.
Oh, yeah, and he also did a documentary about Shakespeare, his political parts of his plays and how they were affected by whether the queen was in power or someone else was in power. If you ever see that, it's quite wonderful.
Yeah, it's a really good, it's a great piece. He, and you know that his, I like his stuff too about Will and this sort of the year by year and sort of what, and he really lets you do a sort of deep dive into everything that's happening in this society. And you realize, of course, no writer writes from without their social fabric, right? So Shakespeare was a writer. He was just a guy, you know. He was a guy trying to make a living writing plays is really what he was. And that was as hard back then as it is now.
Yeah. Tell me about it. But let me ask also, I mean, we talk Shakespeare, and you are, of course, now an artistic director of a Shakespeare Center, but you've directed all kinds of things. I mean, you directed stuff off-Broadway like 100 Saints You Should Know, and the first time I heard your name was about a decade ago when you did an off-Broadway show that kind of took off as a sleeper hit called Never the Sinner. Did that kind of change your status a little bit? Did that give you more notability?
Yeah, that was really almost 2 decades ago, but we're not counting. But it was a real big launch, actually, and that was written by a guy who nobody knew at the time. His name was John Logan, and he went on to write the screenplays for little films like Gladiator, a couple of the big James Bond 007 movies, a bunch of really, really great stuff. So. But Never the Sinner gave me a big start. It was a big splash. It got its start in New York at the American Jewish Rep over in Chelsea. A guy named Stanley Brechner was the artistic director, and he'd heard about my production of the play in Washington, and he gave us the spot in New York. And my friends and I had literally put the set in the back of a rental van. It was like the Beverly Hillbillies. We drove ourselves up to New York City, put our little set into his theater over there in a basement in Chelsea, and a couple of people couldn't come with us, so we recast a couple of people. I got another couple of friends to come and do the lights and stuff like that, and we opened, and I didn't think anything more was going to happen, you know? I thought, oh, that's great. I mean, how lucky. We got a show from D.C. to New York. That doesn't happen every day. Aren't we happy to be here and excited? And in fact, there was this guy who was on the board of the American Jewish Rep, and he said, he's a publicist in New York. His name is Jeffrey Richards. He said, I have advance word. I'm sorry to tell you, the New York Times Review is not going to be good. And I went out to dinner with my parents, and I said, well, this was really fun. Enjoy it while it lasts. This theater's a wild ride. I'll be home soon. And I think Jeffrey was playing with me. I'm not sure exactly why, but because the New York Times wasn't not good. It was a rave, and we got a huge picture, and a picture is worth 1,000 words. And Jeffrey wanted to stop being a publicist and start being a producer. And he took an option on the play, and before we knew it, we were in an open-ended commercial run at the John Houseman Theater on 42nd Street, back when there were a bunch of theaters on 42nd Street in New York and not a bunch of apartment towers.
Well, wait, no, you still have the Theater Row there. You're still on 9th Avenue.
And thank God they preserved Theater Row, and you've got the signature. Actually, where the John Houseman was is where the Pershing Center, the Signature Theater Center, is. So there's still, you're right, there's still a theater and a good one there, and we should be very grateful for that.
Yeah, and as you said, Jeff Richards has gone on to produce a dozen plays on Broadway. Did he produce that The Best Man?
He did.
Yeah.
That was his idea. Yeah, he sent me the script for that. And said, "Do you think this is worth reviving?" And I read it, and I said, "Absolutely, hell yeah, it's worth reviving. Let's do it." And and he said, "Good, because I have tickets for us to go to Italy to meet with Gore Vidal next week."
He's just full of surprises, that Jeff.
Oh my God, this guy! I mean, we had such a good time together, so we got on a plane, we flew to Rome. And we went to Gore Vidal lived in Ravello, Italy, on the Amalfi Coast, in this extraordinary villa. And we went to go meet him. And you know, I had grown up in Washington D.C. and I'd gone to kind of a snooty boys' school called St. Albans, and so had Gore Vidal. And it's such a snooty old school kind of school that we actually had faculty members in common, even though we were separated by about 40 years from our graduation dates.
Wow.
So Gore and I hit it off immediately. I loved him. I loved his mind. It was such
the production had fallen through. You got to go to Italy and hang with Gore Vidal in his villa. Like, how many people get that experience? My God. What other experiences, what other, like, unforgettable parts of your life have happened owing to your being a director who goes across the country and around the world directing?
You know, I mean, the thing is, what's the fun part about being a freelance director, now I have a home, which is great, but the fun part is you never know what's going to happen, and then the less fun part is that you never know what's going to happen. And so, you know, I always say I've got two jobs. One is doing the job. The other job I have is getting the job, and quite often getting the job takes a lot more time and a lot more effort and a lot more brain space than doing the job. But, you know, for me, the best part has been you get to meet different people, and there are times, like, when you're sitting in Gore Vidal's villa in Italy and he's telling you about the furniture in his dining room is from Pontius Pilate's breakfast nook in Charlton Heston film he wrote, you know, with the cherry.
Oh, I thought you meant the actual Pontius Pilate.
Ben-Hur. Yeah, no, it was not actual Pontius Pilate, but from the movie of Ben-Hur, it was the furniture that had been in Pontius Pilate's little breakfast room and that was in Gore's dining room. But you're sitting there and you think, that's when you think, well, if I become a lawyer or a doctor, this probably would not have happened.
Although, if you become a lawyer or doctor, you can probably afford Pontius Pilate's maybe.
Well, there's that, and you know what? You know, that's something we don't. If you choose, or is the arts chooses you, you have to be prepared to sacrifice, because we don't get compensated the way other professions do, and sometimes that's tough to learn. I'm trying to buy a car now that I live in Virginia, and you know, I've got good credit, but try going into a car dealership and when they ask you the financing questions, they say, so you have a job? Yeah. How long have you had this job? 2 days.
You gotta wait 3 months before you get that car. Definitely. But here's, you know, you talk about the itinerant stuff and then now you're planting roots. You are married to a gorgeous and adorable actress named Nancy Anderson, whom I remember from one of my favorite musicals of the past 20, 30 years, A Class Act on Broadway, and she's done some...
Oh, that she was the bomb in The Class Act.
Oh, I'm telling you, what a hottie. And I love that show. It's a wonderful show. But she is a New York and elsewhere actress. Now, you know, was there a conversation you had to have with her of saying, we're moving steady here, boom, we're living in Stanton, Virginia, you know, does she get to
well,
know?
She's almost even more excited about it than I am. So she told me she's always had a fantasy about living in a more rural part of the world, and this is going to be our big chance to try that out and live down here for a while. And you know, the thing is, rabbis, we're on the road all the time, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, she and I, right now she's up in Auburn, New York, doing a world premiere of a new musical version of the book Anne of Green Gables. I'm down here. I'm going to go see her show and pick her up in a couple of weeks and bring her down here for a visit. And then, you know, we're going to keep our place in New York City, too, because we figure we're back and forth and forth and back there. So we just try and keep it going. She did send me, I will say, her other big fantasy is she's always wanted a 1940s pickup truck, and I got sent 6 different Craigslist advertisements yesterday. I'm trying to buy, like, you know, a sensible Subaru, and I think she wants me to go buy a beat-up pickup, so.
I'm more of a Subaru man. I'm in Colorado with my friend Dave right now. Subarus are great, I can tell you. They don't outlast hail damage very well, but otherwise they run and they're great and they go. But so does absence make the heart grow fonder when you're in the arts and you're both artistic people? She's an actress, you're a director, yeah, and you're away for several weeks at a time. Is that in some ways better for a marriage than other people who are like every day, boom, 9 to 5, come home, dinner on the table, watch TV, go to sleep?
You know, maybe it is. I've never gotten. Sometimes we always think the grass is greener on the other side, and like, wouldn't it be nice if we could see each other all the time? And you know, we just had a time where we were together for like 4 months, and it was great. We loved it. But by the end of it, we were like, great, have a great, good luck on that show. Yeah, great, luck to you too. Good luck down there in Stanton. Okay, I'll talk to you. I mean, listen, we talk every night, and absence can make the heart grow fonder until about 3 weeks, 4 weeks in, when then it just makes the heart grow cold.
Okay.
And you know what, I think, and I've talked to a lot of, I talk to actors about this a lot, and one of the really awesome things about some of the wonderful company down here at the American Shakespeare Center is we got a bunch of couples down here. We got people who are together, who are acting together. Sometimes they're combinations of actors and a costume designer, or an actor and a props person, or a musician, and it's really important to me to offer ways to support people who are together and to support them as artists together, because I know from this life how difficult that can, what a strain it can put on you. But what I say is we try never to go more than 3 weeks. Like, that is almost the maximum, and at the end of 3 weeks, someone's got to go find the other one, no matter who has to go where. And that's just sort of that's the rule, and that's how we've worked out our lives. So
now, speaking of the structure of time, I'm always curious about this as being the artistic director of a big organization, of this theater company. How much of your day, or perhaps a given week, is spent with A, creative stuff, B, organizational stuff, and C, raising money and talking to great white whales and asking them to put you in your will, in their wills?
Right.
You
know? Right. So as you might suspect, I'd say proportionately C is the highest activity at the moment. But no, the reality is this. I mean, for instance, we at American Shakespeare Center, we perform 50 weeks out of 52. This is not a summer theater or something like that. This place is in business all the time. So we got to be, we're always working on what comes next. I have a little window right now, because I just joined up, that the first show I'm going to direct won't be until next spring. So that's actually, you know, that's
almost a year.
That's more time than I've had off from actual directing in a long, long time, which is good, because it gives me a chance to sort of settle into the organizational part and get enough practice at it that when I do go into directing, because directing is, you know, that's an 8-hour-a-day activity. So that means that anything else I'm doing as artistic director has to be done around the outside of that. But
right.
I'd say the you know, we're a not-for-profit regional theater company producing the classics. If we do well at the box office, but there's no way that what we could make at the box office, unless we were going to start charging the kind of ticket prices that would mean that our audience wouldn't be able to afford to get here, and right now it's an incredibly affordable ticket and we want to keep it that way. If we had to start charging that, then we'd lose audience. So we have to go out and raise money from the community, from foundations, from the state, and you know, what we've got, I think, is one of the other thing, and I should talk about this a little bit, because we don't just produce here in Staunton Stanton. We have a fantastic touring company.
Keeping the touring going.
That,
yeah.
I told you the history of, I mean, the DNA of this place is this concept of touring. And this is one of the really great Shakespeare tours that is done in this country. And they get out there in a couple of buses and trucks. It's a cast of 12. They're bringing this year three plays in repertory, Shakespeare's A Winter's Tale, Shakespeare's Comedy of Errors, and Antigone, and they perform from Maine to Texas between September and April. And you have just as much chance of seeing an American Shakespeare Center production out on the road as you do if you come here. So that's they're a big springboard, as well as an opportunity to reach into a bunch of communities that wouldn't get a live Shakespeare performance in their community otherwise.
And so the touring shows are not...
And schools, yeah. But they go everywhere.
But the touring show, it's not as if you do a show on the main stage, and then if it goes really well, you send it out to tour. The touring shows are almost separate?
Yeah, they are separately programmed. So this is a separate company of actors that coexisting with our main stage activity. And then when they finish their tour in the springtime, after they're sort of tied to the academic year, so they tend to go out between, you know, Labor Day and Thanksgiving, and then after New Year's until, you know, exams start,
right.
I guess.
Yeah.
So around about late April, early May, they come back and we put them on our stage for 6 weeks.
Oh, that makes sense. Okay, so yeah.
And that's sort of after they've been out all over the country, they come home and we welcome them home and we produce them as our main offering. And there's an audience that comes here and they love that work because it's been, you know, it's been informed by what they've learned out there in America.
Huh. We've been talking with Ethan McSweeney, the new artistic director of the American Shakespeare... Hold it, I've got to get this correct here. American Shakespeare Center of Staunton, Virginia. Everybody, you're going to want to check that out. You're going to want to spend a weekend there. And also, if you want to find out more about Mr. McSweeney and all the stuff that he has done prior to taking this job on, you can go to ethanmcsweeney.com. And here, this always pisses me off too. You put the U in Staunton and you don't pronounce it, and you've got the last name McSweeney and it doesn't have a third E in it. How did that happen? Where's the E
before? Have I?
Yeah.
First, this is the bane of my existence. Okay, so here's how. My family, it's McSweeney. For years, you know, everyone spells it N-E-Y except my family. My father says, well, that's because we're from the original line of McSweeney's from Ireland. And I think, yeah. You know, I'm about as Irish as you are. I mean, I've been fourth generation American. I don't really have a strong sense of that. And sure, Dad, sure. And I'm sure that's what Granddad said to you. And we all believe that we're from the original line. It's just somebody. It's however some guy spelled it at Ellis Island when we came in, right? So I'm working in Ireland finally. And first off, I get back over there and I start directing plays and I discover, guess what? I am Irish after all. It was really kind of fascinating to like be surrounded by people who kind of look like me and thought like me. And I was like, I didn't really realize that I came from someplace. And a good friend of mine over there is a genealogist and historian and an actor. And he says to me, he says, well, you know, I'm not going to do his brogue, but he says, you know why you only have two E's? And I said, no, Denny, why do I only have two E's? He said, well, it's because you're from the original line in Donegal, and I know that because you only have the two E's and not the three.
Wow, so look at you.
So there, my grandfather and my father were right.
Huh. And so I'm wondering, you're not a raving alcoholic, come to think of it, if you're that Irish. I'm kidding, I kid.
Yeah, no, that's the American side of me has taken care of that.
Now, this authentic part of the way of Shakespeare that you do, I didn't get to ask before, but I assume you have seen what Mark Rylance was doing a couple of years ago when they were doing The Twelfth Night, and I think we did Richard III, where it's, again, authentic, I mean, candle lighting on the stage and authentic instruments. And A, what did you think of all that if you saw it? And B, where are you guys in relation to what that was?
That's a great question and a great example, because that work that Mark was doing comes from the Globe Theatre in London, which is also in the same vernacular of trying to practice and explore Shakespeare through the performance conditions that we think were prevailing at his time. So we're in the same family tree, and in fact, one of our founders, Dr. Ralph Cohen, who is an absolute Shakespeare genius and really the emotional, intellectual center of this place. He was a big participant in making the Globe in London happen, and he's on the Architectural Review Board there, which is the group that kind of makes the serious decisions about what fits into their performance style. So you know, Rylance and Mark's wife Claire Van Kampen as well are both very big inspirations for us. I don't think of it as rules of what you can't do. I think of it as a contemporary artist being told, here, you don't have any more tools to tell this story than Shakespeare did. Now what will you do? So it's more of a challenge to go play in Shakespeare's sandbox and bring who you are and see how it goes. So here's some of the things that are like that. We do what's called universal lighting. So the light, we have electrified candles in our performance space at Blackfriars, and they stay on the whole show. So if you're used to sitting in the dark, that doesn't happen. And you know, that changes the relationship of the actor to the audience in a way that is really phenomenal. And if you've never experienced it, you're going to love it, because what happens is you can't hide now. You can't, you're not just sitting there, you know, watching somebody who's better lit do their thing. You're a participant. And when in Shakespeare, we know among the favorite devices is the soliloquy, where one actor stands and talks to the audience. Well, this is really hard to do for an actor when the audience is just this amorphous blob that they can't see. But it's a totally different relationship when we can see you and you can see us. And so that's a big part of what we do. We also follow the staging, where the stage is a thrust stage, which means the audience sits on three sides. And in fact, at the Blackfriars, our best seats in the house are on the stage itself. And those would have been where the nobles sat, partly because they were the best seats, but also because they came to the theater to be seen at the theater. Mm. And so they wanted everyone to know that they were there and what they thought about the play. So those seats we call the gallant stools, and they are on stage. And you can buy them, and when you come, and I really encourage everyone to try them out. But if we haven't sold them all, we give people an upgrade on the spot. So we'll call out in the pre-show and say, if anyone wants to upgrade, we have two empty seats over here. So we can, it's like an airplane. You can get one.
I love that.
At times.
Will you have groundlings, like throwing apple cores and things from the balcony?
Yeah, we don't hand out apple cores and tomatoes. So that's a place where we're not quite as potentially authentic. And we don't require you to sit there silently, God knows, but we may not experience quite as much back and forth conversation as we think could have happened in the Elizabethan era.
Well, maybe in the indoor theaters it wasn't as crazy as it was in the Globe. I mean, maybe in the indoor it was more a sense of decorum, since you had nobles, and it wasn't like this all day let's go to market and see a show thing that literally stretched all day with a five-hour play and all this time in between and commerce going on. Maybe, I don't know.
I think that's entirely correct, and it's mostly because, yeah, it was nobles, and also the ticket price was higher, so, you know, it kind of kept some of the riffraff out.
And yet, even back in 1603, they did Greece. A little joke there.
We've done a few. We actually did one of our most successful shows is before my time, but we did the musical Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson, which had been done on Broadway, and we did that here unplugged. So all the music was played, you know, live by the actors, and nobody was mic'd, which I think is a great way to do a musical. But the reason they did it was because it was a history piece, and just like Shakespeare was writing histories, that was a contemporary history, and you know, it was a big success.
Huh. Now let me ask you: you must have your first season planned out. I know you know you're going to be directing. What are you directing in the spring?
I don't know. That is what I'm doing right now. I'm working on planning what will be my first season. So there is a great season underway right now. We are in the thick of our rep, and we are running with productions of Richard III, Jane Austen's Emma, in a really wonderful adaptation, As You Like It, one of Shakespeare's most beloved comedies, and a wonderful Elizabethan play called Jacobean play called Man of Mode that's very rarely produced. So you can come here now and see those productions. In the winter, we move to a very different kind of season called the Actors Renaissance season. And the idea in the Actors Renaissance is we take 12 actors. They're almost always people who have been here before, so they know what they're doing. And they do 5 plays in rep,
Aye.
1 week of rehearsal for each one, and get this, no directors. So this is really like what it used to be, because they didn't have directors in Shakespeare's time, and the actors weren't given the full script of the play. They were just given their side, right, just their lines. Didn't have Xeroxes either, right? So, I mean, one reason you do that is save on ink and some poor scribe somewhere to write it. The other reason you would do it, it was a way for the playwright to keep their intellectual property from getting pirated by anybody.
Oh.
Only the playwright had the complete text. There's a reason why Shakespeare's works were not published until the end of his career. His fellows didn't want them published in his theater company because they had the rights to produce them. And if they'd published them, well, any Tom, Dick, or Harry could have done King Lear, right? So that's one of the reasons why we've got so many what they're called corrupt or bad quartos of something like Hamlet, because it was such a popular play that a bunch of different people would go and try and recreate it from some bits that they could get.
But when these 12 actors that you have coming in the winter, well, they just get their own... Well, I mean, the plays they're doing are famous enough, they probably know the script of the other people or not. What are they actually doing?
But the point is that they focus on learning their part. They show up for rehearsal knowing their part fully and ready to go. I mean, which is sort of a little bit different than how we approach it. And then we don't give them a whole lot of time, so they kind of have to go with their first impulses. And the actors collaborate together to use, they go into our wardrobe and they create the costumes from what we've got, what exists. They use our prop shop and they go in and they find and pull the props that they need to do the shows. And this year they're going to do Henry IV Part 1, Merry Wives of Windsor. One other two. Oh, Bell's Stratagem and Arden of Faversham. And we're going to introduce our big new initiative, which I mentioned earlier, Shakespeare's New Contemporaries, and our first winner of our Shakespeare's New Contemporaries competition is a play by a woman named Amy Whiting that's related to Merry Wives of Windsor called Anne Page Hates Fun. That's going to be done in the winter, too. So we've got, there is so much theater being made here. It's really just...
Well, you're 52 weeks a year, and you're a Shakespeare Center in Stanton, Virginia there. Let me ask you, before we let you go, what, first of all, yeah, and you don't have to name names or anything, but what's the worst experience you ever had directing, not just Shakespeare, but anything? What was, like, a hell show for you?
I agreed to do an off Broadway play while I was very busy doing The Best Man, and I didn't read the play really carefully, and I read it once, it looked good, I agreed to do it. I sent it to a designer friend, and the designer friend said, sure, let's do it. And because he and I were doing it, some other friends of ours said, sure, let's do it. And because we were all doing it, this incredible cast came together to do it. And then we all got there at the first day of rehearsal, and we read the play, and we all looked at each other, and we went, well, this isn't very good. And, you know, we were a little bit, it wasn't anybody's fault. It was a good, quick read. It just didn't quite add up when you went to really go do it. And gosh knows, we were sort of stuck, because now we'd already, the producers had already committed to renting a space and producing a play. And I even went to them and I said, get out while you still can. Why don't we just fold up shop? And they're like, no, we need to produce this. And so we all went forward into it knowing full well that it was going to be a bloodbath. And boy, was it.
Oh, dear. Well, the producers are at fault, too. I mean, they probably read it more than you guys did. So they chose. Did they have an ulterior motive?
I know. I helped choose it. They'd actually sent me another play, and I'd read that one and said, I don't think this one. And they sent me this one, and I said, oh, you know, okay, maybe. And then they said, okay, maybe is good. And I said, maybe is maybe. And then they said, okay, we're in. We're doing it. And then, you know, before I knew it, I was doing it, and I thought, okay. I thought that's... I was young. I didn't know. I didn't have the... I wasn't very smart about knowing what I could and couldn't do and what I could and couldn't fix. And I got a lot smarter since then about knowing the limits of what my abilities are and how to work within those. And this was just one. It was just funny because literally everybody looked around after closing the page on the last the script on the last page and the first reading, and we looked at each other and went, "Oh, whoops."
Well, that's interesting that you mention what you can and can't fix, because most of the scripts that you work with are not brand new and changeable by the author. So how do you fix, quote-unquote, something in a script that might be 20 years old or in 400 years old?
Well, I mean, if it's a new work, then we're working with the author, and the author is the primary creative artist in the theater, and when I'm doing a world premiere, I always say it's not my world premiere, it's the writer's world premiere, and they are the final decider and arbiter of what goes and how, and I want them to have an absolutely, you know, their experience is the most important one to me in that. When you're working on an older play, if it's 40 years old, it's one thing, because probably there's an estate that still has some control over what you would do. So like when I did a recent Long Day's Journey into Night by Eugene O'Neill, the theater wanted me to cut it because O'Neill wasn't kidding. It was a long journey into Night. But I said, sure, I want to do it, but we got to make sure we run the edits that I make have got to be run by the estate to make sure they approve. If it's a 400-year-old play, like a Shakespeare one, well, there's no copyright left, so it's all public domain, which means we have a lot of latitude as the interpreter to look at the text. And with a Shakespeare play, one of the great things about the work we do here at American Shakespeare Center is we do it super fast because, you know, famously, Shakespeare comes out and says in Romeo and Juliet, the 2 hours traffic of our stage, but most productions of Romeo and Juliet are 3 hours long. So we believe that it was done at a really great clip without transitions, people talking continuously. It was a really vigorous exercise. But we still find that we have to cut the plays a little bit to get them into the two-hour window. And frankly, you really want us to, because there's some of that stuff I try and cut very surgically so that you don't really see that anything is missing. But I can take out a line or a reference here that would simply confuse you. And if I take it out, it makes the meaning of everything around it clearer.
Well, that's, I don't know if you could do a two-hour Hamlet, though. Hamlet, you still have to cut to get it to 3 hours, quite honestly.
Yeah, that's true. Hamlet, yeah, I think there's exceptions granted for Hamlet. But I will say, when we did it here in the Actors' Wren, I think it was about 2:15, 2:20, and they weren't going fast. Like, you didn't go, oh my God, they're talking too fast. You were kind of breathless. It was like watching a sporting event, because it was just kept going, and you know the score kept changing, and you weren't sure who was going to win all the way to the end. So it really sustained this momentum that was really exciting.
Well, it has been exciting and momentous and a big win for us having Ethan McSweeney here in the neighborhood with us. Just want to tell everybody one more time, go to see a bunch of shows. Go spend the weekend in lovely Stanton, Virginia to see the American Shakespeare Center. Sign up, subscribe, or just come down for a weekend and see their shows. Find out more about Ethan McSweeney with only two E's in there at ethanmcsweeney.com, MCSWEENY, ethanmcsweeney.com. Last question for you before we let you go. Of all the Shakespeare shows that you've ever seen, what was the most indelible for you as an audience person?
One of the first ones I ever saw was A Midsummer Night's Dream. I was 5 years old. I was at the Folger Shakespeare Library in Washington, D.C. I was in the front row, and I laughed at something that probably a five-year-old shouldn't have gotten. Probably I didn't get it. I just thought it was funny. And Titania, there was a little pool of water in front, and there were some little lilies or something floating on this water, maybe some little silk lilies or something. And Titania bent down and blew them onto my face, and I was in heaven.
Oh, I'm so glad I asked that question. Oh, we are in heaven, having talked to Ethan McSweeney in the neighborhood. Mr. McSweeney, I just wish you so much success and creativity and funding for this theater and for you in your career going ahead. It has been a delight, and we thank you and shalom to you.
Shalom. Shalom, Rabbi. It's been wonderful to talk to you.